Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. We know you've probably got a lot of leftovers around your house, so we're giving you a dose of second helpings also. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, and this week we're going to revisit some of the standout moments on State of Belief from 2007. We'll hear our interviews about topics as varied as evangelical Christian colleges, conscientious objectors to the Iraq War, and The Simpsons. I remember that one well. We'll go back to Denver, Colorado, where we visited a most remarkable cafe founded on the belief of food for all, regardless of what you can afford. And we'll hear from tomorrow's interfaith leaders at a summer camp for young people of all faiths. We'll start things off with a soldier who witnessed abuses by the military in Abu Ghraib and other areas in Iraq, and on account of his faith, laid down his weapon and ask for a discharge. Aiden Delgado has documented his time in Iraq and his return home in the Sutras of Abu Ghraib, Notes from a Conscientious Objector in Iraq. The book is available now, and Aiden joins us on the phone from Georgia. Aiden Delgado, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you for having me.
What did you see among your fellow soldiers? For example, what was their attitude about the war, and what was their attitude toward Iraqi civilians?
Well, just speaking from purely my own experience, the vast majority of my unit were highly supportive of the war. They certainly favored going to Iraq. I think by and large they felt that what we were doing in Iraq was related to September 11th. I used to ask them, you know, guys, why are we here? And they would say, well, we're here to prevent another September 11th. So I think that was the space they were coming from and why they felt that we should be there and why they supported the war. Their attitude towards Iraqis changed dramatically. When they initially arrived, there was sort of that standoffishness of entering a new culture and meeting new people. But unfortunately, as time went on, I saw a lot of prejudice and anti-Arab, anti-Muslim sentiment beginning to arise in the unit. And that was very disturbing to me because, as you may know, I lived for 8 years in Cairo. I could speak Arabic. I was much more attuned to the Middle Eastern lifestyle. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of the rhetoric back home about Muslims and terrorism, and they're all terrorists, they're out to get us, I think that had really affected the guys in my unit. When I was leaving Fort Stewart, Georgia, getting ready to deploy to the Middle East, I was having a conversation with one of my friends about the Middle East and Islam and Iraq. And this master sergeant turned to me, and I wasn't saying anything radical, and he turned to me and said, well, if you love them so much, you should go join Al-Qaeda. And I thought, wow, that's a bit of a shocking response. And then later on, the same person told me that Muslims and Islam were two different religions, and that Osama bin Laden was the head of Islam. And so this was coming from such a deep, fundamental ignorance about the situation, about the history, that really gave me pause, and I thought, my God, you know, people are going to war. They may have to make life-or-death decisions based on horribly faulty information like this.
Were these attitudes a big factor in your disillusionment about the war?
Yes, you know, I think they were, and I think that it's not as trivial as it sounds to say that the attitude of soldiers about Iraqis affected me. I think it contributes to a whole aura and a whole atmosphere, and that the racial slurs come first, and then it's the casual brutality, and then it's the serious brutality, like what happened at Abu Ghraib. And I think that was one of the turning points, because I had always, as a youth, I had always thought of the American Army as the good guys, you know, the reluctant heroes, the people who don't want to fight but only do so when it's thrust upon them. And then when I was in the war zone and I saw the attitude of some of the guys becoming the opposite, becoming looking for a fight, enjoying a fight, wanting to start trouble. And that really disillusioned me about what I thought the Army was all about and what I thought being a citizen soldier was all about.
Did this attitude of treating the Iraqis so horribly come from the top?
You know, I can't say that it originated at the top, and I'm not going to say that it was ordered. I think what it was an attitude of active neglect, in the sense that the officers didn't take a hand in the day-to-day operations deliberately. And they sort of, while the cats are away, the mice will play kind of attitude, in that it's a wink and a nod. You know, we know what's going on, or we suspect what's going on, but if we're not actually there, then we don't have to stop it. And I think that's more the attitude that contributed to Abu Ghraib, rather than a direct go forth and do this to this person. And I think that attitude went all the way down the chain until everybody had plausible deniability and everyone can say, oh, I didn't know. It wasn't me personally.
Do you have any advice for those people in the military that are struggling with the same feelings that you were struggling with, and yet they're not going to be granted conscientious objector status?
Yeah, you know, I recognize that reality, because the truth is conscientious objector status is very class biased. It's for white-collar people who've written essays, who've gone to college, and it's very difficult to win it if you don't have that background. But the thing I would say is that there are other options, and I think that there are less objectionable options than being on the front lines. I think being a medic or being in the support jobs may help alleviate some of that conscience. But the other thing I would say is that making a public stand and saying that if you really believe that it's wrong to participate in this in any form, then you have to come out and say it. And whether that means applying for conscientious objector status or being an activist on your personal time, on your off time, following your conscience is the highest freedom.
Aidan, I have to say I admire your courageous conscientiousness. And Aidan Delgado, I thank you for sharing your story with us on State of Belief.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
Still to come, we peek behind the doors of the institution known as God's Harvard. And we'll read from the Gospel according to the Simpsons. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy. This is a special look back at State of Belief here on Air America Radio. Welcome back. I'm Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief on Air America Radio. Last May, we took the show to Denver, Colorado for the Interfaith Alliance's National Leadership Gathering, and it was in Denver that we came across this subject for our Your Voice segment. Brad Berkey is the proprietor of Same Cafe, a restaurant he opened with his wife, Libby, about 7 months ago. You simply pay what you think the meal is worth and what you can afford. In the cases of some customers, they pay what they can, and sometimes that doesn't mean money.
My name is Brad Berkey. I am the co-owner of the Same Cafe, So All May Eat Cafe here in Denver, Colorado. We came up with the idea. It was a progression through, you know, years of volunteering at different shelters and soup kitchens. We were cooking, we were feeding people. We loved that part, but we wanted to make that more of our life. We wanted to do more with it. This idea hit us to, you know, what if we had a restaurant, a standalone restaurant with no prices on the menu, where anybody could come in, pay what they felt was fair, and get a good, healthy meal. I was, and still do, IT work, 20 hours a week outside of the restaurant, and my wife's a full-time school teacher. We don't expect everyone to be able to pay restaurant-style prices. And then we also, of course, have the option of, if somebody doesn't have any money and they'd like to volunteer, then they're welcome to do so. They can come and exchange an hour's worth of labor for a meal. We keep track of the number of customers and folks that come in every day, but it's totally anonymous. We don't know who's leaving what. We don't know if one person left every dime that's in the box and everybody else was eating for nothing that day, or if everybody was chipping in an exactly equal amount. And that was really important to us, is that we wanted people to be able to come in and not have to make known that they needed help. And Libby and I were both raised in Christian homes, and we were raised to volunteer and raised to give back to the community, and that's really where this all came from, was through that upbringing. But there's no religious background to the restaurant itself or to our organization. You know, we're non-denominational. We don't have any church backing us or any organization for that matter. You know, we're self-funded. It's our own faith that started it up, and we'll keep it going.
My name is Nancy. I live in Denver, Central Denver, about 10 blocks from here. What brought me here the very first time was an article that was in the local newspaper Westward, and I've been coming back ever since because the food is so great, and Brad is wonderful, and all the people that volunteer here are great too.
My name is Juan Garcia. I live in Denver, Colorado. In this place, there's no cash register. You pay what you want to pay, and the food is delicious.
I'm Suzanne Magnuson from Denver. I had pizza and a Greek salad and a lemon cookie. It's delicious.
I'm a soup, salad, and pizza kind of person, which is what they have, and as well as cookies. But there's always a great choice, and everything is nutritious and organic.
Mostly organic foods, you know, made from scratch. We do our own pizza dough. We have our own cookie recipe. The restaurant itself is very open. When you walk in, you notice that there's no walled-off kitchen where the cooks hide in the back and, you know, your food's prepared and then brought out to you, and you never see what's going on. We wanted to make sure that it was, you know, an open environment where, you know, we could interact with everybody who comes in. We want to know about you and about your life if you want to share.
The door really is always open. It's wide open, like it is right now, and it's always like that. And so you really just get this open feeling, and then the sunflowers on every table, it just has a very happy, warm feeling.
A woman walked in here the other day that it was her 90th birthday, and she wanted to come in and check it out because she's seen my last name, and she wondered if I was any relation to a guy that she had taught for back in Illinois in a little farm town community schoolhouse, and it turns out that was my grandpa. So, I mean, just really cool things like that, where if I was behind the wall of a kitchen, just absent from being out here in the midst with everybody, I'd probably never see that type of stuff. We have no staff here. Our staff is 100% volunteer. That's another big factor of why we've been able to stay open as long as we have, because we have people that come in, they're able to share, you know, 5 minutes or 5 hours of their day with us, helping us do a few dishes or, you know, sweep the floor. Without them, we'd be a lot harder pressed to be successful. There's this general belief that all people are going to cheat you somehow, but in our own hearts and our minds, it's most people are good, and if you give them the chance, they're going to do the right thing.
Journalist Hannah Rosen spent a year and a half following the students, faculty, and administrators at Patrick Henry College. Her experience and findings are recounted in a fascinating new book, God's Harvard, A Christian College on a Mission to Save America. Hannah Rosen joins us right now from her home. Hannah, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's begin by you doing a quick profile of a typical Patrick Henry student.
Okay, a typical Patrick Henry student was homeschooled by a Christian conservative family. Can come from any part of the country, California, the Midwest, East Coast, they're all over the place. They get to Patrick Henry with very high SAT scores, somewhere above 1250 is about the average. Some of them have gotten 1600s on their SATs, and so they would have gotten solicitation letters from Yale or Harvard or places like that, but decided to go to Patrick Henry instead. They're incredibly politically motivated. They believe in what they call the Ministry of Political Activism, and that's how they get to Patrick Henry, because the school sells itself specifically as a place to train the next generation of Christian leaders. They might also be interested in other subjects, like there are students interested in Hollywood or interested in working in magazines, but their aim is to get explicitly to the highest levels of culture and politics.
Is there a typical career trajectory for the students that you met?
Yes. I mean, the pinnacle seems to be getting a White House internship. That's what they all strive for. And so every year it's kind of known who got the White House internships. And short of that, you can work as a sort of volunteer in the White House just to have White House on your resume. That's your starting point. If you don't get one of those, tons of people work for conservative senators and congressmen. And they've done a lot of politicking as homeschoolers already, so they're pretty familiar with that world. So basically, the school, half the school is kind of Christian liberal arts, and the other half of the last 2 years, they're doing almost a vocational education where they're really pushed to work out there in the world. And then after they graduate, they work in a congressman's office or a senator's office. A handful of lucky ones get jobs at the White House. They've had tons of graduates go on to the White House. And or they work in magazines, but they like to stay in Washington. That's the goal.
How successful have they been getting in the White House?
They've been extremely successful getting into this White House. They've had as many internships in this White House as a place like Georgetown, which is much bigger and has been around a lot longer. Every year they seem to take up a few of the spots of the 100 White House interns, somewhere between 1 and 5 of the spots, which for a new tiny school is a large number. They've had graduates work in Karl Rove's office. They've had graduates work all over the White House, actually. And then they've got a ton of people on the Hill. I mean, you know, when I go with the kids on lobbying trips near nearly every third office we stop at has a Patrick Henry graduate working in it.
I'm wondering, how did your Jewish faith play into the relationship between yourself and the people you encountered at Patrick Henry?
Well, that's really funny. I mean, that the relation, I've been covering an evangelical community for a long time, and there's this sort of funny, condescending, love-hate relationship that evangelicals have with Jews. And so people are, on the one hand, intensely curious and have a kind of narrow knowledge about Jews, but they're very, very interested in Jews. And on the other hand, you know, they see Jews as kind of unfinished. So the story I tell in the book of somebody in James Dobson's circle staring at me and at one point just blurting out, "You just look so biblical," by which he meant beautiful. And at another point, somebody saying to me, you know, staring at me again and saying, "When I look at you, I see the blood of our Savior coursing through your veins," you know, which is sort of like a shocking thing to say to someone over breakfast, but that's what she says. And so it's a very funny relationship. And I've heard that some of the younger students, when reading my book, have said, "Oh, I see, you know, this is an interesting book from a Jewish perspective." So it's sort of a way of distancing any criticism, is just describing it as from a Jewish perspective.
Hanna Rosin is the author of God's Harvard, A Christian College on a Mission to Save America. Thanks for being here and sharing your reporting with us on State of Belief.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, don't go away. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from Mark Pinsky about the impact of religion on America's favorite animated family, The Simpsons. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio.
This isn't going to be about Jesus, is it?
All things are about Jesus, Homer. Except this.
You see, Lisa, your mother has this crazy idea that gambling is wrong, even though they say it's okay in the Bible.
Really? Where?
Somewhere in the back.
I don't know who or what God is exactly. All I know is he's a force more powerful than Mom and Dad put together.
Homer, I'd like you to remember Matthew 7:26. The foolish man who built his house on sand.
And you remember Matthew 21:17.
And he left them and went out of the city into Bethany, and he lodged there?
Yeah. Think about it.
Welcome back. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is our look at State of Belief in 2007. And one of our favorite guests is Mark Pinsky, religion reporter for the Orlando Sentinel, and author of The Gospel According to the Simpsons. Upon the release of the Simpsons movie this past summer, we spoke to Mark about the 18-year relationship between the Simpsons and religion. Mark, welcome back to State of Belief.
It's an honor and a pleasure to be back.
How does the show achieve such a balance, somewhere between ridicule and praise, when it comes to religion?
Well, as the critics have said for years now, it's a show that rewards intelligence. The more you pay attention, the funnier it is. And I think, to some degree, the smarter you are, the funnier it is as well. And they have this way of, over time, because they have the luxury of season after season, of making these characters so well-rounded. You can see the things that are good about them and the things that are maybe not so good about them. I mean, even a character like the pastor, Reverend Lovejoy, who, as we know, does not love joy, although he can be hypocritical, he can be venal, his sermons can be boring, but even over time you see his character. He suffers from preacher burnout. He has a shrew for a wife. He's always having trouble with money. And so all the characters who are ongoing characters are really presented in a full figured way, in much the same way that Ned Flanders is. On the surface, he's kind of a doofus. He's overzealous. But underneath, he's just got this great, great heart. I mean, he lives his faith, he believes, and he acts from the social gospel, and he's not a hypocrite. As a religion writer, I like to say that the chief undermining sin of Christianity in the last 400 years in this country, at least, has not been sex and not been money, but hypocrisy. And Ned is anything but a hypocrite. Hmm. And Homer, his next-door neighbor, heaps scorn and abuse on him, and Ned always returns it with love.
Did you see this right away, or did it grow on you?
I saw it in bits and pieces. I was not an early fan of the show. As a reporter, oddly enough, I was in, when I worked for the LA Times in Orange County, California, I actually wrote some articles about disputes about Simpsons t-shirts in elementary schools. But I was not a fan, and only until about 1999, 2000, when my kids, then 8 and 11, wanted to watch the show, did I even watch the show regularly. And so we started watching it together, and the first thing I saw was that it's okay. It was okay for my kids anyway. And the second thing I saw was all this religion. And I began taking notes. You know, as a journalist, your personal life tends to become fodder for your professional life. And that led to an article, which then led to a book.
Now, Mark, I know you've had what I would think is the pleasure of talking to a lot of the show's writers and producers. What's their take on religion in the show?
When I first broached the subject to them, they're very reluctant to cop to it. I mean, they have this reputation as an edgy show, anti-authoritarian, you know, real attitude. And first they denied that it was there. And then I began to cite them literally chapter and verse. And they said, well, yes, it's there, but the reason it's there is not for any missionary purpose or any evangelical purpose, but it was an act of creative desperation, is what they said. And that is to say that they never thought the show would last as long as it lasted. And the characters never age. So that limits the kind of situations you can use in a long-running domestic situation comedy. But because of the culture, the American culture, where in the early decades of TV, network TV in particular, religion was sort of off limits because the sponsors were afraid it would offend or would dilute, whatever. This had not been done to death by previous long-running sitcoms. So when The Simpsons sort of stumbled onto it, they found this was already an unplowed field, and it offered this wonderful opportunity to use these situations in their characteristically clever way, that hadn't been, as I say, done to death by other situation comedies.
I imagine that you've got a favorite episode dealing with religion. And if so, what is it?
Unquestionably, it's Homer the Heretic. This is just a wonderful episode. I'm told it's used in seminaries around the country. It deals with so many questions. Homer decides he doesn't want to go to church anymore. So his family goes without him, and he stays home. And it illustrates the issue of, why do bad things happen to good people? His family freezes, the heating breaks in the church, the door freezes shut, the car breaks down. Meantime, Homer's living the sybaritic, happy-go-lucky life at home on the couch, drinking, smoking, winning radio contests. And then they come back and they try to talk him into going to church. And he says, approaching the issue of a one true faith, he says, well, what if we pick the wrong religion? We're just making God madder and madder every week. Perfect, right? And he goes on, then he goes to sleep and he has a dream, and God comes to him in a dream, which is perfectly out of the Old Testament. And they have this really sincere dialogue about why worship may or may not be necessary.
Thou hast forsaken my church.
Well, kind of, but...
But what?
I'm not a bad guy. I work hard and I love my kids. So why should I spend half my Sunday hearing about how I'm going to hell?
You've got a point there.
And then Homer's house catches fire when he's not going to church, and the members of various faiths are members of the volunteer fire department. They save his life. The evangelical Ned Flanders runs into the burning house twice to save Homer because he's so stupid he ends up back in the house again.
The Lord is vengeful.
Oh, spiteful one, show me who to smite, and they shall be smoten.
Homer, God didn't set your house on fire.
No, but he was working in the hearts of your friends and neighbors when they went to your aid, be they Christian, Jew, or miscellaneous.
Hindu, there are 700 million of us.
Oh, that's super.
Tell me what you say in response or write in response to someone who sends you an email and says, religion is far too serious to be a part of anything so funny.
Well, I mean, I say that you can reach a serious point by beginning at a silly point. You really need to reach people where they are. And what I've found speaking around the country at college campuses in particular is when young people are in a lecture hall and the subject is theology or spirituality or religion, a veil of skepticism seems to descend. To some degree, that's a good thing. At the same time, if they're on their couch or they're in the commons room and they're watching a cartoon on a Sunday night, their minds, I think, are more open to different concepts if they're presented with these concepts from an entertainment perspective.
So when you look back on your work of writing about The Simpsons after having studied about The Simpsons, what stays with you as an enduring principle applicable to what you do day in and day out?
This, I think, there's a dichotomy by the way, in the way that religion is presented in The Simpsons, and I think it reflects society as a whole. That is, that the church, that institutional religion, like every other institution of modern life, is subject to satire, as subject to doubt, skepticism, cynicism, and to some degree, contempt. By the same token, sincere religious belief is respected, and spirituality, sincere spirituality, is respected. That's the dynamic of The Simpsons, and as I see it as a religion writer, that's what I see out in the world.
Mark Pinsky is the author of The Gospel According to The Simpsons, which is now available in an updated second edition. Man, it's always good to have you on this show. You're so insightful. Thanks for being with us this week on State of Belief.
Well, Welton, it's always an honor to be on your show.
Up next, tomorrow's Interfaith Leaders Today. And we'll revisit my reflection on the resignation of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Remember him? I'm Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief on Air America Radio. This is State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, and we've been looking at highlights from 2007 on this show. I'm reminded of how much fun we've had together so far this year. One of the very best highlights of the year for the Interfaith Alliance is the annual LEAD Summer Camp, which stands for Leadership Education Advancing Democracy and Diversity. We spoke with some of the young campers this year, and their thoughts and ideas reveal a great deal about the future of interfaith leadership in this country.
My name is Aaron Match, and I come from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and I am Jewish.
I'm Ben Lukens. I come from East Rockaway on Long Island, New York, and I am a UCC Protestant.
I'm Ryan Nakasone. I'm from Hawaii, and I'm Buddhist.
Malik Jamal McKinnon. My hometown is Raleigh, North Carolina, and my religious background is Christianity.
My name is Tanya Bracci. I am from Tampa Bay, Florida, and I am a Shia Ismaili Muslim.
My name is Kendra Stewart. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm a Christian and a member of the AME Zion Church.
My name is Ben Chadwell. I come from Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. I am Jewish. Probably the most important thing we learned was how to get our message of not only tolerance, which is putting up with other faiths, but pluralism, which is reaching out to other faiths and trying to understand them.
I had never been in an environment where religion didn't matter too much, and there's all these different ethnicities around me, and it was just this easy atmosphere to be in. where we could just ask, oh, what faith are you? And they would just respond without feeling uncomfortable.
North Carolina is, at least where I am from in North Carolina, there isn't that much diversity. I know a few people from other religions, but it's not much. I don't get to really experience them. If there are other religions that maybe we aren't aware of that actually are there, but they just don't get a chance to really show themselves, maybe we can give them a chance to come out and share their beliefs.
My plan itself is I want to start basically a political action group back at my school, as well as connecting the youth of my church with the different churches around my community. I feel like there's a lot of ignorance and apathy, and I figure the faster we get rid of that, the faster more people will take charge.
One of the things we're based upon of in our democracy is the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and that's how we became what we are today. And to see those documents in real life, the actual documents, that was probably the most emotional part of that experience. And I actually just took the time to stare at the actual Constitution, and I just read the preamble. Being able to stand there in front of such a protected document that's fading, but the preamble is just there, dark and bold, and I just took the time to read it and really think about it. It was really touching, and that was probably my most emotional experience.
My goal is to create a jazz band, an interfaith jazz band. So, because music is one of the things that brings people together. We would have different instruments from different cultures, and we would all be together. And the first step would be to get the word out there that something new is coming.
Amen. Back at the end of August, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez announced his resignation. Here are some thoughts that I shared with you when he made that announcement. It was in my Preaching to the Choir segment. I'm sure some of those thoughts were on your minds too. The Gonzalez resignation disturbed my imagination and raised questions in my conscience. I know the dirty laundry list of charges leveled against this man, who seemed to act more as a loyal friend of the president in the White House than as the chief law enforcement officer for the people of the nation. Unprofessionalism, affronts to the constitutional provision of religious freedom, political decisions crudely peddled as legal actions, development of egregious guidelines on torture, and personal declarations that prompted serious questions about his credibility. To be sure, the legitimacy of any one of those items more than justifies Mr. Gonzalez vacating the office of Attorney General for the United States. But the worst damage this man inflicted on the nation may not be fully apparent until it is revealed through future attitudes and actions. What happens to the psyche of citizenship in a nation when its chief law enforcement officer does not respect the law? Attorney General Gonzalez sent a message to the American people that it's all right, it's permissible for a government official to decide which laws to obey and which laws to disregard. Well, if it's all right for the leader of the United States Department of Justice to not tell the truth to the United States Congress, when, where, and how can we demand United States citizens to tell the truth? If the Attorney General can have a come-and-go loyalty to the law, what is the future of the rule of law in this republic? This man, Gonzalez, like many of his colleagues in the present administration, messed with our minds and distorted the language of our revered political and interreligious heritage. He joined and contributed to a culture in which unprincipled participants gave new meaning to words and thus raped our trust in simple declarations. If yes means no, how can we be sure of anything? When the confession, "We did not do that," actually means we did that. Where can we find statements of reliable meaning? How can our nation continue to value integrity when clean skies means polluted air? Secret intelligence is equated with prejudiced persuasion, and the historic terminology of first freedom is mutated into the biased rhetoric of a partisan politician seeking to compromise the Constitution. As a lover of words who values patriotism and responsible citizenship, I find myself frantic over the grand theft of language that will leave our society with no terms of solid meaning and no means of trustworthy communication. This theft destroys trust, breeds misunderstanding, and ultimately erodes the foundation as well as the possibility of real community. So as Mr. Gonzalez departs from his role as Attorney General, we have work to do. Cleaning up a pile of stinking debris that, if not removed quickly, will turn even justice and freedom into ugly, offensive words in which people have no confidence. And then we will have no way of talking with each other or with the world. Good riddance, Mr. Gonzalez. And my words mean precisely what you think they mean. For the good of our nation and for the preservation of our most fundamental moral values, I'm glad you have resigned the position to which you were appointed by President George W. Bush. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for being here with us. I hope you've had a good Thanksgiving weekend. If you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at stateofbelief.com. Or you can always call us at 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. State of Belief is produced by the Interfaith Alliance Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, which means this show is supported by listeners like you who become members of the Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. I'm thankful for all of you who listen to State of Belief. Next week, with presidential candidates in attendance, will this year's Global Summit on AIDS become politically unstable? We'll see what the event organizers have to say. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.